I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
This is Bill, and welcome to episode 040 of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. Today's episode is entitled The Middle East Shuffling to the Apocalypse, Part 2. Now, in October of last year, I had episode 027, in which I discussed the Gaza-Israeli conflict that had inaugurated itself by a Gazan invasion on October 7th across the border, causing much mischief and mayhem in Israel proper. Since that time, Israel has been doing everything they possibly can to erase Gaza from history and the map. Now, I followed that up with episode 037, Storming America, where I talked about, in reviewing Fortune's book and Schlichter's book, where he upscaled the attack to CONUS to the homeland here and tried to replicate what that would look like, and I talked about that then. Well, it appears it's time for me to revisit both of those episodes. You may not find it necessary to listen to them before this. I think that I'll cover this in a fashion today where that kind of preamble will not be necessary. May be helpful if you choose to do so. You know the sequence. That would be episode 37 and episode 27. I'd like to thank those readers who reached out to me as a result of the previous two episodes in which I covered stoicism, and in the very last episode I covered moral injury, which is a topic that is very close to my heart and spiritually very important to me that doesn't get the kind of coverage or attention it should among most Americans or Western listeners who may be given a listen to this podcast. Thanks for the kind words and stuff that people have written me concerning those two episodes. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can write my email at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Or look up the Chasing Ghosts podcast with show notes on Substack concerning those episodes and this episode. And as a matter of fact, I've tried to make it a habit not only to include references in those show notes on Substack, but to let you know, because of interest on the part of my readers and listeners, what's Bill reading, and you can find out what that is, and maybe we can even correspond about that. On Saturday, the 13th of April, reports have been received that Israel came under attack from Iran with a drone attack that was launched against Israel. Either this was a response to the Israeli destruction of an Iranian embassy in Syria or other missteps and contretemps both of these countries may have had over the past few years or decade. A little bit of housekeeping very quickly. Those of you who haven't either listened to my podcast sequentially, which isn't necessary, or you haven't listened to all of them, you'll find that there is a bricklaying attitude that I have about this podcast, in which not only through the invention and writing and scripting of new episodes, I find myself going down other rabbit holes or places of historical interest or curiosity, but I find that I'm starting to pile on to previous concepts, and it starts to allow me to remove the layers of this very complex onion that we call global conflict and the civil wars and the larger wars and the smaller wars and the tiny wars and the conflicts, and the fact that a lot of these wars, especially the larger ones, tend to uncork and fan the flames of the embers of conflict that have been brewing among all of these countries. As I've mentioned before, from the western reaches of Mali, practically to the coast of Africa, the western coast of Africa, all the way to Pakistan and India on the border there, where there is a constant martial kerfuffle between the Indians and the Pakistanis in the very high-altitude campaigns in the Hindu Kush, we find that there's a conflict ribbon there that is almost seamless. as all of these countries are involved in either a civil war, civil strife, or war with one another in alliances that tend to be rather mercurial. And as most of you know, and if you don't know, you're going to know now, this is neither a Republican nor a Democratic nor a conservative nor a liberal podcast. This is a one that has a pox on all of those political houses and finds them to be equally perfidious and just tremendous in the magnitude of malpractice when it comes to the craft of war, the conduct of war, or even better yet, the cessation of war and stopping it from happening in the first place. One of the key themes of this podcast has been the impossibility of Western nations to win counterinsurgencies, at least since the end of World War II. But I suspect that even if we went before 1945, we would find conflict after brushfire war, after small wars, after conflict in which the West has participated and ended up in a denouement that wasn't of their choosing and did not get the outcomes that they wished. I just recently got finished reading a book called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World by Evan Thomas. And to put it quite succinctly, what Eisenhower did as a result of his prestige from having been the chief, the Supreme Allied Commander that wrested Europe from German domination in World War II, which ended in May 1945, in no small part due to his efforts in crafting, steering, and helming an alliance that could be problematic at times, and taking a stable of very talented general officers and such, and winning the war, as it were. He's elected president, serves from 1952 to 1960, and Evan Thomas teases out a lot of very interesting aspects of that presidency, among which is that you'll find, much like the Trump years, and again, this podcast doesn't have a political affiliation, but Trump was the first president in my lifetime who did not get us into another new war or conflict. Truman was the same from 52 to 60 because his carrying of a very large stick and his dominant attitude that if we go to war, we will go to war to win, and he managed to convince all potential Marshall competitors in the 1950s that he would do that very thing. Therefore, for the most part, peace reigned around the planet during that time, and America did not get involved in any of these problematic and very awful small wars that have plagued the country since 1960. Now, what was also interesting when you read the book is that in the final chapters, here we have President Eisenhower. He's left. JFK has come into office. JFK and LBJ go to him for advice and counsel on occasion. And as a matter of fact, in one anecdote that I found very relevant, probably not only to JFK, but to every president in between JFK and the present administration in D.C., is that JFK had asked him, well, with Bay of Pigs, which has obviously failed in a very large fashion, I would ask my listeners, I'm not going to trouble you with it now, if you're interested in why the Bay of Pigs fiasco was so awful, which is very close to my heart as a guy who was born and grew up in Miami, and I find myself very close and have always been close to the Cuban community, a disaster of biblical proportions for the Cubans, for Cuban liberty, and for folks who lost their relatives down there. What's interesting is JFK goes and he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, so it ended not in the way that I wanted it to. What do you think happened? To which Eisenhower retorts, again, paraphrasing, well, did you have your interagency guys, your CIA guys, your DOD guys, your Pentagon guys, did you put them all in a room and ask them to hash this out in a way in which you didn't speak to them separately, but you let them air their grievances and disagreements in a big room and have an intellectual brawl of sorts? To which JFK says, no, I didn't do that. Because what he discovered is that because some people, in this case, the CIA, had a disproportionate influence on the conduct of JFK's foreign policy, specifically when it came to the Monroe Doctrine, that he had not been listening very carefully nor lending much credence to those naysayers in the Pentagon who said that this is simply not going to work for the following reasons, and fill in the blank. Now, this is something that I have characterized as strategic deficit disorder. It's the means by which, when crafting strategy and grand strategy being bifurcated from strategy, where strategy can be a solely military domain, whereas grand strategy tends to extrapolate and try to wargame those second and third order effects, possibly even unintended consequences, of getting involved in a conflict like this and making the questions using Ono's five whys or vigorous Socratic drilling or bringing in a tenth man or a red team of contrarians to play this thing out prismatically and decide, well, is this to the nation's benefit? Will this be neutral or beneficial to American national security now? Will it be so in the future? And what one finds now, especially in the last 24 months plus, since the special military operation presaged the invasion of the Ukraine by the Russians in February 2022, America and its allies find themselves not only at odds with the Russians, but they find themselves caught up in a whirlwind in which the entire world order has been topsy-turvy, turned on its head, and again, they find themselves on the rear foot. America consistently seems to conduct diplomatic rake stomping when it comes to this. As I've said in the past, why can't the American State Department, for instance, a very left of center collectivist and New World Order oriented institution of the U.S. government and its allies, and you find that diplomatically the same wharf and wolf of the diplomatic ecology in NATO is almost identical to this. Maybe it attracts those kind of people. But I would also think that with those kind of people, they would think that peace, and no, I don't think that appeasement is a four-letter word, they would think that negotiating, in good faith, of course, and bringing people to the table, even during a conflict, no, ideally or optimistically, before a conflict even occurs, to talk things out, to settle differences, to negotiate, to find ways around going to war. But since this military operation has started and during this administration, there has been no motivation, it seems, whatsoever to even talk, to be at the peace table. I've often thought, why doesn't the State Department, the moment in February 2022 when this happened, rent some very august, nice, and luxurious quarters in Switzerland and have very expensive conference tables and chairs and IT support and anything that they needed for folks to come there from the Ukraine, from Russia, and any other interested parties and try to talk this thing out even as the shots are being fired and the war is being conducted? Of course, we've seen that this hasn't happened. As a matter of fact, we've seen an open hostility as Boris from the UK was somebody who almost single-handedly torpedoed any efforts whatsoever of the West to get the Ukraine and Russia to come to the table and hash this out and talk it out. Now we find ourselves, the United States and the West, in the same position regarding Israel. Saturday, the 13th of April, apparently Iran, as I mentioned earlier in the preamble, launched drones, swarms of drones, against Israel, infrastructure, military bases, you name it. Now, of course, we have conflicting reports. I have a rule of thumb in which I wait 72 to 96 hours, and I read across the board of whatever the available information is, everything from Al Jazeera to the Collectivist News Network and everything in between, to try to come to a single most accurate picture of maybe just what transpired. Now, having a passing familiarity with the very sophisticated drone technology that the Russians, the Chinese, and surprisingly, especially the Iranians, have been coming up with, the Iranians have provided what's called the Shahed technology to the Russians. this has influenced the generational increases in technological sophistication of the Lancet loiter ammunition and other such. And what you find with drones and UAVs is that, as I have mentioned before, when you can spend less than $50,000 to service a target that costs $4 million, in that salvo competition over time, even the most deep and richest coffers, in this case the West, can't afford to maintain the cadence, delivery, or frequency of weapon systems that can be destroyed so cheaply by the opposition. What I did find interesting, and I'm not certain the quality of the information, but apparently this was a limited strike by Iran in which the Iranians communicated to the Israelis that this was a revenge strike, as it were, for having leveled their Iranian embassy in Syria. This could very well be the case, but who knows? It's not as if Hamas is only funded by the Shias in Iran, because Hamas, unlike Hezbollah, just so happens to also get Sunni money from various other countries in the Middle East. And what's also interesting is that if you dig around, you discover that Netanyahu, and all of this is documented apparently, has been flirting from 2014, 2015, and 2016, and we know reports through 2019 and 2020, and using Qatar as a cutout for funding of Hamas in order to put the Palestinian Liberation Organization back on their heels domestically in the Gazan political spectrum in fighting Hamas and Hezbollah and others for mastery of the Gazan realm, in that apparently Netanyahu has been not only funneling some funds from Israel proper, but providing the vehicles for those funds to get from Qatar and other organizations to Hamas in order to supply them with the training, weaponry, and cadres that they have. There's nothing new about this. If you go into the United Kingdom's history when it came to dealing with the Irish between 1968 and then the peace accords in the late 90s, what you find is that in some cases, MI5, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and organizations from the SAS to political organizations and police organizations in London were setting different permutations of the IRA against each other and funding it as a means of making the enemy eat themselves apart or maybe blow themselves apart in a form of intersectional cannibalism. I have concerns of a wider war. I have concerns of America getting involved and having its fingers in all of these color revolutions and armed conflicts and civil wars and martial strife and larger wars, and what has been done in the first near-peer and peer conflict in generational memory between the Russians and the Ukrainians, and the fact that I would think, unwisely, the United States, for the most part, has shown its martial hand and tactics, techniques, and procedures and materiel, particularly when it comes to air defense assets and things like that, everything from the THAAD to the Patriot to the man pads like the Stingers and everything in between that has been used to prosecute the war on behalf of Ukraine against Russia. And one will notice that the whole domain of air superiority, air supremacy, air dominance, those three permutations that were such common buzzwords in the Pentagon and the American DOD for the longest time are no longer in the dictionary because they have temporal limitations. In other words, those are things that, one, unlike World War II or other conflicts, that will not be established, where all of a sudden we have from 44 to 45 in World War II over Germany in the European theater of operations, and one can say roughly in the same time period in the Pacific theater, as a result of Japanese and German airmen and aircraft being reduced to such a small number that they no longer were a threat, and one could say that you had air supremacy or air superiority, and that would be permanent. That would be a permanent and fixed instantiation of the planning for the conflict from that point forward to wear the enemy down, bring them to the table, and in the case of World War II, bring them to unconditional surrender or conditional surrender in the case of contemporary conflicts. What we are living through right now is a complete reassessment of what is viable and what isn't viable as far as the utility of a lot of these very large and sophisticated systems that have been on the battlefield for generations that no longer have the efficacy, nor I would say the survivability, to be on the battlefield now. Now, that's everything from America's obsession with a carrier force to America's obsession with manned aircraft and America's obsession with manned tanks, because it just so happens to be my conceit that the era of manned tanks and the era of manned combat aircraft are over. We just haven't recognized it yet. Let's just hope that America and the West doesn't empty out the magazine and weapons cupboards bare to such a point that once that discovery becomes manifest, it doesn't put us in an existential crisis in which we are no longer, as country or countries, able to defend ourselves. Which brings us to the other end of the spectrum, which is a specialty of this podcast, of course, which is the asymmetric spectrum, the gray zone, the hybrid zone, the small wars, the insurgencies, counterinsurgencies, and all of these small conflicts, all of these conflicts in which you have these very low density forces employed that allow certain combatants in this new world in the 21st century to use tactical means to achieve strategic objectives. One can say what just happened in Iran and Israel is one of those very things where they use maybe tactically and operationally sufficient by definition drone attacks against Israel proper to include civilian infrastructure and military infrastructure as an air basis and those kind of things, in which they're employing these in limited numbers in a low density to achieve a strategic objective. The strategic objective in this case is the fact that, as others have observed, the West has a penchant for underestimating its antagonist and its enemies and looking at Iran and saying, it's just a simple third world developing nation that's just been so backwards for the longest time that they simply aren't a threat outside of their country. Now, this threat is twofold. Number one, they have a very real ability, which one can put in the top 20th percentile planet-wide of drone warfare. They are probably among the leaders of drone warfare, astonishingly enough, for a country of their meager means and station on Earth. Now, of course, they've gotten help from the BRICS countries in this case, China, Russia, and by extension, India on occasion. But what we discover is that they are changing the face of warfare. They may even be helping to inaugurate what's referred to in the practice as a revolution in military affairs. One can call the use of the stirrup a revolution in the military affairs. One can instantiate that the introduction of firearms was a revolution in military affairs, because for the most part, when firearms could be used en masse, then it means that accepting missile weapons like archery and slings, things like that, for the most part, single combat becomes an anachronism, where mass forces massed against other mass forces can take a conflict on the nose and cause vast casualties. And by the way, that American genius and capability of mass manufacturing of old, the legends that we've heard of World War I and World War II, and in the way the military-industrial complex could not only produce wonder weapons, but they could produce them at scale and lots of them. That capability, I am declaring dead. We don't have the fabbing infrastructure. We don't have the manufacturing infrastructure. We've had a U.S. Navy that has failed since the introduction of the Burke, which is relatively successful at 70 keels laid down and currently in service, I think, since 1991 as a destroyer. But since that time, the U.S. Navy has developed the little crappy ship, the LCS, which finds itself retired 5 years into its 30-year lifespan. And they will make far better coral fish homes than they would anything else. There's the zumwalt, which somehow, some way, it was discovered that the only armament that it would have, which was not a 5-inch gun, but something called a lurlap, and you can look this up, would be $1 million a round. So they canceled that part of it and had VLSs, which are vertical launch systems for SM series missiles, which are very good missiles that are shipborne. Now, in spite of the fact that the Germans recently had a mishap with two SM missiles from one of their ships, in which they set the ship on fire as a result of either misfires, engineering casualties, whatever the case may be, the Zumwalt is unable to do that. And as a matter of fact, I found this out and I was astonished. Since the Zumwalt's keels were laid, and then from that point forward, they went out to the ocean to get all of their certifications done, a missile, one single missile, didn't leave a vertical launch system in a Zumwalt until 5 years after it had been operationally certified as part of the U.S. Navy's capital warships. And then we have the USS Ford. Now, I've done an entire episode on why I think that aircraft carriers are an anachronism. And right now, whether we like it or not, they're zombies, and they've gone the way of the crossbow and the chariot, and no one seems to have recognized that. I always think to myself, well, can something else be discovered about that shipwreck that's on the surface called the USS Ford that's even worse than things that I knew before? Well, it just so happens that the last 2 months a report was issued in which they said that there is going to be a mean time between failure of their launching system, which is an EMALS, which is an electromagnetic aerial launch system, and retrieval system. Instead of using steam catapults, the Ford used what's called concurrent technology, which wasn't perfected at the time, to say that we're going to make this almost railgun-like, but it's railgun minus, in which we're going to use electrical impulses for aerial launch and for retrieval instead of the tried and true steam catapult system that has been used since World War II. Well, guess what the mean time between failure rate is? On a steam cat, it's 1 in 35,000. On a Ford, it is 1 in 115. What that means in sortie generation is that if you have a sortie generation that sends aloft, let's suppose, we're going to be conservative here, 4, 8, 12 aircraft per hour, you do the math, one of those in a 12-hour span of time is not going to make it. There's a reason why our aircraft carriers, fortunately, have that 15-degree offset where they launch aircraft slightly to port, which means left on a ship of the front of said ship, so that the carrier, which has to travel at approximately 30 knots for launching into the wind to get the loft combination of the launching system, full military power on the throttle of the fill-in-the-blank of what that's going to be, could be an F-35, could be an F-18, whatever the case may be, and that combination of full military throttle, the launch system itself, and steaming into the wind at 30 knots is what gets that aircraft aloft. They have the 15-degree offset there. Maybe this is originally what the naval architects wanted to do, but it's there so that the ship doesn't actually run over the aircraft if it goes into the drink. And with 115 instances until a mean time between failure occurrence can possibly, or in this case, probably happen, that means that you will have pilots in the drink. And by the way, when these kind of aircraft are lost at sea, and we're talking blue water, usually not retrieved, if they're lost at sea, for instance, like John McCain's a reverse ace who lost 5 aircraft from under him, 3 of which were training aircraft, they could get those out of the very shallow Gulf waters outside of Pensacola and do an examination mechanically to determine what caused it to have to be abandoned. So none of this bodes well for the ability for cutting-edge technologies by Western standards to win the future near-peer and peer conflicts that the U.S. in these wars of choice may find itself encountering. But what I wanted to cover today was, I just wanted to cover that briefly, but what I wanted to cover was, what are the implications of this Iranian and Israeli conflict heating up? Well, the existential galactic implication is a nuclear war occurs as a result of the Israelis launching nukes against targets locally in the Middle East, maybe Iranian targets, and what those implications would be for the BRICS, in this case China and Russia and other countries, and the United States, and whether that would cause a chaos avalanche of other countries also launching their nuclear weapons. Because one thing that we know for sure is that the vaunted Israeli Defense Forces have proven out to be, like their American sugar daddy, a paper tiger of sorts. They've had a really bad run living on their military legend of 1973, because in 1982 and 2006, among other conflicts, one can read the Winograd Commission report from 2006 to see just how bad things were for the Israeli military at the time, and not much has improved, as evidenced by the October 7th, 2023 massive intelligence failures in Israel, not to detect the rather eccentric and very curious incursion by Hamas during that time when they came over the border and wreaked havoc and mischief and mayhem and murder and all the rest of it. What we have to concern ourselves with, I think, as America and as Americans, even though I know I have listeners from all over the world, and I thank you for your solicitude, is that, as I mentioned in episode 37, Storming America, where I talked about William Fortune with Day of Wrath and The Attack by Kurt Schlichter, both books I commend to your attention. And if you put everything down and read both of these books, start with Day of Wrath. It's a novella. And I would say that Schlichter's book, The Attack, is an upscaled version of what that Gaza attack, October 7th, 2023, of last year, would look like if that very same attack indices and formations were upscaled for an American attack over a 72-hour period of time, what that would look like. The scariest thing about both of those books is that all of that, humans, can happen tomorrow morning here. If we were to find ourselves waking up in the morning, and those of you who have read Schlichter and Fortune, and you discover, well, what is this? You'd say, those guys were seers. They were prophets because they called the ball on what this would look like. I don't necessarily want to repeat what I said in episodes 27 and 37, respectively. In 27, I talked about the Israeli attack and the intelligence failures and just the surprising lack of preparation and the absolutely awful intelligence preparation, intelligence reading, and the fact that they seem to be caught totally with their pants down when this occurred in such a fashion that you can't even countenance, but how could that happen and why aren't people losing their jobs? Well, in episode 37, where I talk about Storming America, and I'm talking about Fortune's book, and even though he did write one second after, which I really enjoyed, and Schlichter's book, where I talked about what's going to happen here if they upscale that kind of jihadist fire-and-forget entity or modality here in the United States to attack CONUS. And when I say CONUS, could be an attack on Alaska, could be a contemporaneous attack on Hawaii at the same time, individual attacks, who knows what the case would be. All the technology, manpower, and means and tactics, techniques, and procedures to pull off what both of those gentlemen surmised in both of those books that I recommend you read, all of it is entirely possible, if not probable. I hate to say this, but I don't think it's a matter of if it will happen. It's a matter of when it will happen. It just so happens that my darling bride was off visiting grandchildren, and she was due to come back in 2 days. I asked her to come back today, and she is, because I'm very concerned. Because, for instance, what happens with the number of NOx, non-official cover, sleeper cells, illegals? And when I use this term illegal, I'm using it in two permutations. The first permutation, of course, is illegal as all of us know it, which is those coming across the border either seeking asylum or they just so happen to bypass all U.S. Border Patrol control entities, and they come in here and they're basically in hiding or they're basically in the underground economy, much as the Mexican cartels, which are expanded by other cartels from other country monikers that have been feeding this underground economy with personnel material for the longest time. Now, not only do you have that illegal permutation, the other illegal permutation you have is the intelligence community apprehension of illegals, which is also almost synonymous with NOx, which is non-official cover, which is intelligence entities overseas, to include Israel, by the way, that send in folks who come here not only illegally, but they have fraudulent paper. They come here and they have a very robust and wide and deep underground material and auxiliary infrastructure that supports them, provides them with intelligence, things like this. One can even say that maybe there's linkages between them and Antifa or Antifa-like entities in America. One thing that Schlichter talks about in his book, and I know he has an axe to grind when it comes to this, but it makes perfect sense when you tease it out, is that when those 72 hours of mayhem are launched across contemporaneously the country from coast to coast, and the first day they strike public places, the second day they strike residential areas, the third day they strike infrastructure, that there are college students and college entities and Antifa organizations that provide auxiliary bomb maker, trigger man, and violence and kinetic support to these organizations. For instance, one thing that Schlichter points out is that some of the Antifa auxiliaries are used on all three of those days to spoof and call up 911 and clog up the lines, reporting all kinds of false and basically fantastical calls to get the police running in every which direction except the correct one to meet and service the targets of these jihadists who are attacking Americans and the American infrastructure. Now, one thing that I pointed out that surprised a lot of people, but if you knew the character of the Israeli civilization and country and ecology, if you knew the character of who they are, what they're about, and what they've been historically, they're very hoplophobic. They have very little use for private weapons. They want all weapons to be government weapons that are issued most likely during either reserve or active duty stints by soldiers in Israeli uniforms and IDF uniforms. And as such, they have 1% of their population prior to October 7th. I think that I don't know how far they've gotten in extending that 1%. 1% of the population had private weapons. And if you had that 1% of people with private weapons, apparently they're restricted to one rifle or one pistol and 50 rounds per annum. 50 rounds per annum. Now, those would not only be social work rounds, like hollow points and stuff that one would use for defensive gun use, but also practice rounds, maybe Full Metal Jacket. 50 is absolutely insufficient to maintain one's battle drills and weapons and firearms currency in a fashion in which you could meet a threat in condition black or red, which is combat conditions on a two-way range. I don't know whether they've resolved that or not. And let's suppose that on October 8th, they said, my gosh, having 1% of our population with private weapons and the restrictions that we have on frequency and number of weapons and rounds is insufficient to protect us as a country from this kind of attack as Hamas had on October 7th. It's going to take them months, if not years, to get to the point of where not only do you allow people to go through the permitting process, which I am certain, unlike the constitutional carry that we have here in 28 states in the United States, where you don't need a permit to carry discreet or open. It'll take years not only to put a licensure regime in place, because I can't see them using constitutional carry where they don't have permits for discreet or open carry, because I just don't think it's in the nature of their political ecology. In Israel, you have a party that is left of left, which is Likud, and then you have a party that is left of left of left, which is Labor. Now, what you also have in that country, and I think I mentioned this in episode 37, if you didn't listen to it, is that 93% of all land in Israel is owned by the government. By its very nature, it has always had a socialist or communist texture to what it does, beginning with the kibbutzim and beginning with the Zionist movement, which I had mentioned Martyr Made. Daryl Cooper did a great job with in Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem, where he gives the origin story of the Zionist movement to found Israel from late in the 19th century until the satisfaction of that dream in 1947 and 1948. Recommend it highly. If you go back to episode 27, you will find the links to Daryl Cooper's Martyr Made podcast, which I can recommend across the board. I think he's one of the best history podcasters out there. I can only dream of achieving the kind of depth, breadth, and professionalism that he has in his history podcast. So bottom line in my assessment is that they are years away from having that kind of atomistic and basically almost market-based, if not scattered and high-density weapons ownership that would make any terrorist organizations that find themselves in a mall or a school or on the border at a kibbutz or whatever the case may be, find themselves engaged immediately if they start initiating violence against Israelis. But if you have stripped your entire population of the means to defend themselves by highly regulating or prohibiting the ownership and the use and care and travel with firearms, then you're not going to have the instantaneous response that you would. You will be waiting minutes or hours for help to happen, and much blood will be spilled. So one of the reasons that I am revisiting this entire thing and why I'm calling this the Middle East Shuffling to the Apocalypse Part 2 is because I talked about that Hamas invasion, and I talked about where there were some connections with Iran, but there are other connections where you will find them in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, because Hamas is not an exclusively Shia organization. It's a Shia-Sunni partnership. I'd also mentioned in that episode that what we may find over time is that, and I think that Erdogan's going to do this out of Turkey, is you're going to find a rapprochement, a kind of compromise agreement between the Shia and the Sunni, where they were set their blades down after going at each other for generations and say the common foe here just so happens to be Israel and by extension the United States and by extension whatever European capitals and NATO organizations happen to be partnered with Israel. They will by extension be identified as Israelis, as crusaders, as Jews, as Christians by those Islamic fundamentalists who wish to use this as a means not only to establish that partnership between the Shia and Sunni, but use it as a force multiplier, as a way to lend mass to the fighter elements and fighting elements that they have. As I've also mentioned in the past, there is this notion out there that I think is well documented, that Kenneth Bollock's book, Armies of Sand, talks about this, where conventional operations by Islamic countries tend to failure and not to success for a variety of reasons. I think I covered that in the review and discussion that I did of Armies of Sand. I can't recall what that episode number was, but you can look through my catalog and maybe find it. But when it comes to insurgency, hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, asymmetric warfare, and all of these kind of things, very successful around the planet. What's going to happen if there is a Shia-Sunni rapprochement, and you have Turkey, a member of NATO, by the way, that is an extremely formidable military power by every estimation in a non-nuclear fashion? What's going to happen if, as a result of this contretemps between Iran and Israel actually exchanging fires between each other now, because that did not occur in October, and this is a new permutation that has happened in the past 3 weeks, does this turn into an expanded conflict in the Middle East? Does this insinuate itself as an obligation on the part of the U.S., maybe kicking and screaming, maybe not, to side with Israel and find themselves in a hot war in the Middle East again? Our lack of success in Libya, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the Horn of Africa, in fighting low-density concentrations of Islamists and jihadists, high-density concentrations as in Iraq, finding what happened with ISIS, finding this very odd on-again, off-again Western intelligence community marriage affiliation with Al-Qaeda, where Al-Qaeda is searched out as the be-all and end-all of evil on Earth, yet we find in the 1980s Osama bin Laden, well, then again, Osama bin Laden, along with Saddam Hussein, were very stout allies with the West, and America gave them much treasure to do what they did, many munitions, much materiel support, all of those kind of things. And of course, they discovered, well, over time, maybe that could change. I'm fond of saying that in 1996, the Taliban wrests control finally and consolidates control of Afghanistan. And then they weather not one, not two, not three, but four U.S. presidents and find themselves back in control in the fall of 2021. America and the West does not have a terrific track record when it comes to this. And if I didn't announce it before, and I think that I did, I'm getting addled in my old age as my memory starts to lapse, but I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. Thank you, Scott Horton. But I also want to call out Scott Horton, who has been affiliated with antiwar.com. Antiwar.com is a website that I've been visiting almost daily since 1999, a great source for news and analysis. He was kind enough to offer me this fellowship. Thanks, Scott, for that. But the reason I want to bring it up is not only to brag about that honorarium that's been bestowed upon me, thanks again, but also that Scott Horton, his books, his interviews, all of this, he has the receipts, the footnotes, the encyclopedic knowledge to show you how America's involvement in the Middle East since the beginning of the 20th century has presaged and even almost predicted the kind of nonsense, mayhem, and rake stomping that has taken place as a part of American and Western military adventures in the Middle East. I mean, the very best thing in my estimation is no more military mischief in the Middle East. Step out, buy what you need to buy. Don't get involved in their particular social ecologies or political systems. Leave them be. But of course, we have an intelligence community in America and the West that has found a new toy called color revolutions, and they've been using that to screw around with the planet for the last few generations, really coming to the fore in 1984 and 1986 when it came to the Philippines and those color revolutions that were exercised by the Western intelligence agencies there, and then used to manipulate elections, including, by the way, elections in Israel under Obama's administration. So be that as it may, I want to bring this back to something that's a more personal issue for me, a personal plea from me, is that the likelihood, and by the way, I hope I'm crying wolf, I hope I'm 100% wrong, and I hope that my forecast, mind you, not prediction, my forecast of a massive jihadist informed, if not allied with other malefactors and malcontents when this infamous day occurs. I hope I'm completely wrong on making this forecast. But if it happens from a personal perspective, what can you do to get ready? Well, there are a variety of things that you can do. As one of my favorite commentators who passed 2 years ago by the name of Ole Remus would stay away from crowds. That's the number one thing that you can do, stay away from crowds. And then I suppose that I have some folks from both sides of what is the accepted political spectrum in America and the West who listen to my podcast, and there are folks out there who might find this unpalatable and unsavory for me to make the recommendation. But if you don't adopt the lifestyle of having a gun with you at all times, and I understand what the limitations could be if you happen to go to an office that doesn't allow you to have the weapon on your person, but check with their security or whatever the case may be, see if you can keep it in your car. Maybe that's the case. If you live in a very prohibitive state like California or the entire West Coast, where Marxism seems to be in the Pacific Ocean for some reason and instantiates itself in the respective capitals, or you're in the Sovietized Northeast of America where you can't have those, maybe you can have a baton. Maybe you can have a tire thumper. Maybe you can have body armor, whatever the case may be, even though you'll find in those states you need to look at the laws to make sure that you're doing things that are lawful, even though I think that when it comes to ethical and lawful, that could be problematic itself, because we have to keep in mind that when Anne Frank was hidden in the attic, she was hidden by people who were breaking the law. And when Anne Frank was discovered in the attic and she was taken away in restraints and eventually made her way to one of the concentration camps, she was apprehended, kidnapped, and put away by people who were obeying the law at the time. So keep that in mind when it comes to your moral compass, because just because things may be legal doesn't necessarily make them right or wrong, but in this case, doesn't make them right. I would urge you that if you haven't armed yourself or armed members of your family, find somebody who you know, an acquaintance, a friend, maybe even a family member, especially a family member, who knows their way around a pistol or a rifle, and they've been doing it for a while. Test drive what their recommendations are, go to the range, do the dry fire, send rounds down range, get professional training, get the very best training that you can afford, because remember, if you have a $10 head, you get a $10 helmet. When it comes to protecting you and your family, and as a man, I like to pride myself on the fact that I provide and protect. Those are the two things that I do as a husband and a father, and I would think a friend to some of my better friends, that is my obligation. And then, of course, the very controversial notion that I have is that men are expendable and women aren't, which means that when it comes to protection, I'm going to do whatever it takes to protect my wife, my daughters, my nieces, my friends, whatever it takes, because that is my obligation as a man to do so. So I know you may find this an extraordinarily odd plea in an asymmetric warfare podcast, but I'm very concerned by the gray zone, hybrid, and asymmetric implications of waking up tomorrow morning in discovering that Schlichter and Fortune's brilliant books have become not novels, not novellas, but actually nonfiction books. So please do whatever you have to do to make sure that you protect you and yours and your family and your friends and your neighbors. It is a duty. It is an obligation. It is something that, well, as Rob Roy would tell us, honor is a gift we give to ourselves. This is Bill. Reach out to me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I have a comment section now appended to every episode on my Substack. And of course, you'll also find my podcast is populated at the Libertarian Institute. If you frequent that, thank you. On occasion, I blog there. And also on occasion, since I've tried to limit the time I spend on X or Gab, because it tends to be a time vampire, there's a notes functionality at Substack that allows me to put brain zephyrs on there on occasion. And you'll find those, and those are all cataloged in time, and there's a number of them there. If you find that you're bored and you'd be interested. So, this is Bill wishing you well. I will chat with you in a fortnight. This is Bill out.